This is Manisha Roy, After Initiation, November 7th, 1992, tape 1 of 3.
Nice Saturday. It could be in the Olympic Valley or somewhere else, but anyway. I think what I'll do to start with, as Lucretia said, she doesn't know how I'm going to do it. I don't either. I'm going to follow the rhythm partly. I always have a hard time telling the night, until I meet people the night before, which is the usual format, lecture and workshop, and the day after. I can't decide until I meet the group what I'm going to do. Although I haven't talked to many of you, but somehow I have to feel the group. I don't know what that means, but I just cannot have a plan ahead of time. And many of you were there last night, and I thought you were a very good audience, very attentive. So I have a feeling what I'm going to do. I still don't know exactly what. But I think I'll start with you telling me who you are, since you're going to spend several hours. It might be a good idea that it's more of a participation rather than I'm giving things out. Hopefully we'll have some, what happens in analysis, hopefully we'll have a sort of a inner dialogue as well as outer, but mostly inner. So, why don't you start from my left? Could you tell who you, what you do a little bit, why you are here?
My name is Joey Kaur, and I have a master's in poetry.
In poetry?
Yes, but I write technical poetry.
Interesting.
Well, I have another one at some point. And so I'm here just for freedom, release, show me a ritual. Mm-hmm. I'm a Christian vine, and oh, I'm the mother of four children, grown children now, and a therapist in private practice in Big Harbor, and I specialize in family. And I'm very interested in ritual, working with young children and adult adults. And then I'm the co-chair person for the program. Pretty interesting.
And I'm Nikki Lagorny. I live on Lonely Island near Bellingham. I practice as a psychotherapist in Bellingham with mostly in the meditation. I really like to put that into practice because I work for a private group. A lot with art therapy, play therapy, and beginning with some sand play. I'm so interested in that. Mother of two children. I'm presently going through a divorce and midlife stuff, so it's a good place to come and talk about initiation and things you do.
I didn't get your first name.
Chaudel.
How do you spell it?
T-R-A-U-D-L. That's short for my child.
Chaudel.
Once upon a time, I wanted to become a therapist and then ran out of energy, but I'm still a painter, interested in symbology, and recording secretary of the society, and the mother of three cats.
I'm Dennis Jarn. I work as a bus driver for Metro, also a sculpture major in the design. And my wife is a therapist. She was here last night.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm going through personally what could be defined as the initiation process. And so I'm here to put her to learn more about the process.
My name is Diane Bowe. I'm cashier for the Young Society. I work with the secretary and the board, no children, no ritual in my life very much.
And I'd like to work out there. And with my heart. And I find, I guess because I think about the whole midlife stuff, I'm finding less and less inner satisfaction from fulfillment from reading journal writings and much more pleasure and meaning and depth in reading Jungian oriented kinds of things and drawing and writing in those pieces.
Thank you for being here, all of you. Just listening to you, I was making some notes about some of the common queries and questions and experiences that you're coming from. One thing looks seems to be right is the age group. I don't want to offend anybody or touch any complex, but is there anybody here below 30? All right, I'm going to go. Huh?
Did you say almost?
Okay. How many between 30 and 40? One. How many between 40 and 50? That's the majority looks like. How many between 50 and 60? Okay. So, how many between 60 and 70? Okay. So we have two ends of the spectrum, one between 60 and 70, and one, in the English, have a very nice term. They say wrong side of 30 or the right side of 30. So I'm sure you are right side of 60, and you are right side of 30, meaning before 35 is right side of 30. After 35 is the wrong side of 30. So they make the distinction. I don't think it exists in this country. Anyway, so we have this one end of the right side of 60, one the other end, the right side of 30, or wrong side of 30. And in between, we have this major chunk between 40 and 55, I would say. So you are really in the real critical moment of biological midlife, anyway, all of us here. So maybe we have to keep that in mind, that we talk more on that issue. And I think it's a very important question because, as I said last night, we're beginning to live longer than 60 average only last 50 years or less. And I think it would be last 60 years. Antibiotic was invented in 1936. And that cut down the demographic, changed the demographic pattern. It's unprecedented way because it's... countries like Asia or Africa, the child infant mortality cut down to half, death at childbirth reduced to less more than half. So suddenly we have this booming of people living longer. So the midlife today is between 40, let's say 40 to 60, 40 to 50 or 55, around 50, 55 for both sexes, women a little earlier, because we are living longer. Midlife in the past used to be, when people lived only 60 years, used to be 25, 28, and so on. But one should not be too stuck with that age, because I have seen people in my practice, even today, who are 20s, in their 20s, are going through midlife crisis in a way. And you can say puberty crisis. But psychologically, things do happen differently in individual cases. But it's a good framework to keep in mind. Even psychologically you go smoothly, it would be unlikely that you would avoid the midlife crisis biologically. So that's one thing we have to keep in mind. But psychologically it can go back and forth, overlap. Somebody can have puberty at 80. That's also possible. The other thing I'm struck by all of your intentions, or let's say hope, what you might hope to get from today or from yesterday and today, is to be able to make some rituals in your lives. And I presume that you already think the benefit, the value of it. That's why you want it. You want to buy something in a store, you already know that you need it. So you're looking for some money to be able to buy it. So you want to get it. You want to learn how to make rituals because you obviously think it's important. Now, what I said last night about the transformation in a ritual, do you intellectually or somehow intuitively believe in it? Have you felt it? Now, a couple of you are Catholics. You must have felt it in some, even though it's not, it's quote, and I put it in quotes, patriarchal, I'm sure in some mass or some time you felt it. Those of you who are not Catholics, you must have felt something in your experience, let's say in a funeral ceremony, a funeral. What is it called? It's not called ceremony here, is it? Services. This is an interesting point too, because it is a ceremony. Birthday, or like Kate was saying last night, this whole election must have touched many of you who are not Catholic. as a ritual, as a transformative ritual. People stayed up late and they were excited. They even fell in love with Clinton. So all these things have to do with this. You don't understand why.
I was just going to start expounding on, he's not my type or something.
Maybe not. Maybe there's another figure. We won't say it's Bush either, but anyway. So what makes it so important that it is, it's not so ridiculous as it sounds, because Clinton, whatever he is as a Hindu individual, as a person who is going to satisfy us or not as a president, but it is, he is the symbol of certain things, which is a collective ritual. He is the symbol. Well, he's the beginning of the midlife, in personal life, but I'm not even talking about him as a person. That's why it's so ridiculous when people bring out so much personal material about a president. It's important, but it's not important. He has to have that capacity to carry all these projections and also let people go through collectively an initiation, which is what it is about, which has to do it. The old king is dead. New king has to bring the hope and the aspiration, and that's why the word change was such an important thing in their campaign. Everybody is looking for a change, but we shouldn't be stuck with the word change either, because change happens, which we would call psychologically transformation, happens only when we also go through the first two stages, which is separation from the old and the mourning for that separation. It's easy to say that Bush, those of you who voted for Clinton, or those who are, you know, Democrats, you can say, oh God, it's a good riddance, that old man is awful, etc., and he's so stupid, but that's 2 years ago, perhaps you didn't feel that way that much. He offered something, there was a reason why he was elected. And I always believe that, and that's partly what we are talking about in terms of the temporal being eternal, the depth that we Jungians talk about, to know about archetypes, gives us that dimension which can take us from the literal to the symbolic, from the temporal to the eternal. So I don't mean to digress, but this is precisely the mood we have to keep. And if those of you who are here to learn about ritual, if you can do that with everything in your life, somebody's trying to speak up. Is it through your thing there above your head?
It's very possible. We're very close to a great power.
Interesting. You can't switch it off. Isn't that interesting? Okay, let's say this has to be here. So just invite the voice in. And those of you who are right there, if you hear anything profound, let us hear it. We have to invite it in. Okay, it's coming. We can't do much about it. Maybe it's from Mars or something. Speaking of eternal and cosmic.
Let's see if your voice carries well enough.
All right. You can increase it. If it's rock music, it would be a little problematic. A Gregorian chant, I wouldn't mind, but... There it is. No, she's a wizard with mechanical things. I can't believe that. No, it's very good. All right, so this is one thing I want to emphasize very strongly, to keep it around you, that we are trying to learn how to be symbolic from literal, how to be eternal from temporal. That does not mean we do not need concrete. And that's another thing I want to make very clear, because often people think literal and concrete are synonymous. They are not. Literal has to do with looking at something and just seeing that. But what we are looking at is the concrete, and concrete is essential. All of us are concrete physical entities sitting here. This table, chair is concrete. Everything is concrete. But to say, you're very concrete, what's the word people use? It's interesting also, the word is not used as much. People would use the word literal much more than concrete.
Literal
is what you see and you think that's all it is.
Your perspective.
Yeah, you have, of course, your projection. But let's say, you say this is only a chair, nothing else. All right? And it is only a chair sometimes, but sometimes you might feel that this is where you feel comfortable. It's also like a mother, you know, the stuffed chair people have. So then it gets into another dimension. But if you think too hard, then you are going to lose it. All right. But the concrete is the thing which gives us the literal impression. But concrete is also the thing which can give us the symbolic experience. So these are three entities which are separate. But we need concrete as an essential material before it can be either literal or symbolic. Okay, so that the reason I'm emphasizing on that, that's really the central issue about initiation or rituals, or how to create them, how to benefit from them. You can't create them by a plan. Yeah. Can be either literal or symbolic. And in some things, you have to be literal. See, Hillman constantly criticizes American culture being only literal, and they're only literal. I do not believe American culture is only literal, and you have to be literal in some things. You have to be, otherwise you can't go about in life. But then certain things which are literal also lend themselves to a symbolic approach, and life stages, one of them. If we look at life stages only literally, that now I'm 20, I'm supposed to be such and such. At 40, I'm supposed to be such and such. And then we are really stuck in the literal. And things like that, we have to have both approaches. We have no choice, because all of us are terrified of death, believe it or not. You might say, oh no, it doesn't bother me. When you're 20, you look at death as an abstract, romantic possibility. People flirt with suicides. That's why suicide is so common among young people. Of course, it can be triggered by depression, by this, by that, for good reasons. But suicide is a possibility among young, a lot more than among midlife. And how many people you know who is going through midlife crisis committing suicide? Rarely. They may. Do you know many? They may, but it's not as common demographically as the suiciding young generation. Because death, also flirting with death, drugs, heavy driving, motorcycles, getting to the edge of life, only young people can do that because they are not terrified of death as we are. Because we know it's a real possibility. All of us have to think of it. If we keep avoiding thinking of it, then we're avoiding the concrete reality and we're becoming stuck in the literal of the youth. Now you see the example tells you what literal and concrete is. We got to first look at death on the face and say, yes, now it's a matter of time. 20, 30, 10, who knows? But even if you live, even if you're one of the statistics of American longevity, let's say you live, what's the average? 65 or 70? 72? Even if you live the 72 years, you know that this is a chance. Even if you live the longest, you're going to die in a number of years. And even if you don't live the longest, you might, perhaps you're going to die sooner. So it's a reality. What is the other one? Who is not playing with it? You say something after that. No. But what I'm saying, that for adolescents, it's easier to think of that as a way out, because there's a built-in lack of realistic idea about death. It's more abstract. You know, talk to your children, talk to young friends. Oh, sure, you know, we're going to all die. But can you do that at 60? Because it's more reality. Part of it. But I think it's also archetypally true that when you're young, that's natural that you don't think of death. You cannot think of death because it's another 50 years. Remember when you were 20, how you thought 30-year-olds are so old? Huh? And then, of course, American culture keeps adjusting language by saying young adults. And I don't understand what that does. I mean, young adults, then what the real adults? And what the middle adults? And what? It's almost like not looking at the possibility of death. Because if you keep calling yourself, what is the cutoff point of the young adults ending being young adults? Do you know? 30. And what's the next day?
young is what they are, and we want them to be young adults.
Uh-huh. No. That may be part of the. That might be part of the reason people don't think Clinton is ready yet, because he's just finishing young adulthood. What is the next phase? Nobody talks about it. I mean, in the forms and applications, 30-something, they say. And if you notice, men, women are much more open about saying midlife than men are. They don't like to say, I'm having a midlife crisis, because you three men are exceptions to be here even. But men would say, oh, I don't know, I things are bad, and I need a new wife, or I need a new job, or I need to do some exercise. They would always put it in terms of some activity. They would not label it as midlife crisis. Women seem to be, thanks to the feminist movement, I think, the last 20 years, are much more openly mentioning being midlife. That's the next point I was going to make. The fear of death, even those of us who think we have faced it, comes in indirect ways between both sexes. The obsession of body work, health obsessiveness, health food. You know, health food nut was the term in the 60s. I don't know if it's still used. Health food nut. When you become nutty about something, then it chances are that you are trying to think about death. Now, so the reason I'm staying with death so much, because midlife to death is a very important time for all of us in this room. And what do we do with death, which is inevitable? And we all know that, we all say that, death is inevitable. But what does it mean in the real experiential sense in the day-to-day life from 50 on, or 45 on, or 35 on? It means it's there. Somehow we have to include it in a way that it can contribute to that idea of symbolization and eternal in our life. Now, religions have done it for people who, in the old-fashioned religions, have done it, because they always gave the people a sense of part of a community which is not just humans dying at 70, but also gods and ancestors. And that's what the religion's job was. So you never felt that you are going to end at 71 after your body goes. You felt you are going to go somewhere, and then your family is going to make those pictures of you and keep it alive for the rest of the time. And that was a tremendous consolation for most people who believed in religion. Of course, we have gone far away from that. And we don't really, we are much too rational, we're much too conscious, in the good sense, for better or for worse. We have eaten the apple in Garden of Eden, so we know the difference between good and evil. We know that until we see and touch something, we don't believe it. So we have all this stuff that we evolved for better and for worse, for better as well. We can't just say, just because we are so rational, we don't believe in the cyclical season of life. And how we deal with it is by dropping the thought. We don't even think about death. Some of us do that. The other group, very intelligent, smart people, that's struggling to eradicate it, struggling to conquer it. Medicine, all this research is to, and this stuff, and this whole big issue about Kevorkian, Dr. Kevorkian's helping with suicide. If you think of it, it doesn't have to be only with the fact that somebody is taking the decision in his hand, but also I think it's very archetypal, because the man is bringing up death on face of us. We don't like to think about it. And why is he doing it? Of course, one can argue that he is also taking something in his hand which should be natural. If somebody has terminal cancer, suffering with it, let that person go through what she or he must go through. That could be another argument. But I think it's also, not that I'm in favor of him or against him, I'm trying to think why he's making so much commotion. And it has to do with not only the moral issue about who takes care of death, who decides on it, but also that he's making it much more clear and directly in front of us. People don't like to talk about it. So, and this book that came out in England that was a huge thing about exit, what is it called? Final exit. Why so much commotion? Because we don't want to talk about that. Sex used to be the word in the 19th century. Nobody wanted to talk about it. So the Victorian era and the post-Victorian era, everybody went crazy about sexual activity, but nobody wanted to discuss it because or mention it. It was all in debt. And death is the taboo of the 20th century. Abortion has to do with death. Abortion has to do with choice. Abortion is very, very complicated. People think it's only about abortion. It has to do with many other things. But that's before we get on that tangent. So anyway, death. And we are dying more and more of us are dying of inexplicable, uncontrollable diseases. Yeah. Because nature, now there comes the nature, seasons of life. Nature, I think every time you are at a loss, go back to the natural analogy. It's much more wiser than we are. Nature knows that death and birth have to balance one another. So used to be, and that's why I mentioned antibiotic, used to be natural death of flood, famine, war, balanced the human population to some extent. But what we did, we became so advanced in creating more food, more comfort, more amenities, that we felt that we controlled the natural balance. We could interfere with it. And we did interfere with it. I mean, air conditioning, starting from small thing like air conditioning, we can control the voice, we can keep it, we can preserve it. All this fantastic, magical stuff that we have done with science and technology made us so inflated that we forget that so far we have managed to interfere with a couple of things. And one is birth, one is death. When people tell you after all these contraceptives, oh, I don't know, I guess I don't know how it happened, I just got pregnant. Or the teenage pregnancy. Take the collective sin. These teenagers know from day one, before they even have their puberty, that they can have a pill, no problem. Parents give them, hand them out to them, the mothers, the teachers, like the condoms are being done now. And still, they get pregnant, many of them. Because somewhere the nature interferes. So we can't control things. We think we've made choices, and that goes back to the abortion issue. I think the word choice has several dimensions to it. We don't really choose anything on one level. On another level, we choose to surrender also. We choose to know that we don't choose anything. So if we stick, that comes literal again. If we remain stuck with the word choice literally, then we are in great trouble. Because then we think we are going to, just by passing some bills legally, we are going to take care of all our choice problems. We don't. So, but abortion is a very interesting topic because it becomes a symbol, like Clinton is a symbol. It's a symbol now around which we are going, doing other things. It's a question of male control, female rights. It's a question of female not controlling their own bodies. It's a question of females not really knowing how much they don't control. All sorts of, I think it's more of a control issue than really a baby's life issue. And I think we should see what it is. And if we remain, that's another clue how we can be stuck with the literal. If we don't see the underneath, there comes the architect. We don't see what is underneath. Now I'm going in all these different directions, like the circle we are sitting, you know, I'm going to go in the spokes of a wheel. So that's my usual mode. And if you think I'm getting very disparate, don't worry, I'll come back to the center occasionally. So let's move on to other things that I have heard you say. How to make rituals. I might disappoint you by the end of the day because I might not have any recipe for you how to make rituals. But hopefully you'll have an idea what ritual is. And then you'll see you already have rituals. That might be the only thing I can do for you. You'll see how to recognize the rituals in your life. And that's what consciousness is about. To me, the consciousness is not just how much we know about a subject, but how we know how to recognize something. Cognizance comes from the same root. And that's what the cognitive psychology is about. The map of cognition is about recognition. So hopefully you would be able to recognize a bit where your rituals are. See, the hubris Okay, interesting word that you used. Hubris is opposite is nemesis in Greek. And hubris has to do it, you know, all of you know the meaning of hubris? Hubris has to do it, let's say, very simply, inflation. So you go beyond your capacity or whatever. But the nemesis comes in to take care of hubris. So we don't have to worry too much. There we are. We don't choose. We don't do as much as you think we're doing. And that's what, and maybe it has to do with my culture and also my personality, but culture particularly, because cultures like India, because they're old, they knew from the beginning, they've seen a lot, that you don't really make things happen. Things happen. So if you get inflated, let's say you're doing something wonderful, you wrote a wonderful poem, or you had this session with a patient who just, oh my God, the breakthrough, and you're feeling wonderful, and you're telling your husband and telling your colleague, God, you know, it feels good to be in this profession because of this. And next week, invariably, another patient comes, and I'm sure it rings a bell, with such problem that you don't even know anything. You feel you don't know a thing. So that's the nemesis, putting you down to the humble position. And I think that's very important. But for you to recognize that, there are people who might not see the nemesis. They would say, well, it's not my fault, you know, this woman had been abused 5 times, there's a limit I can do. So we have a wonderful way to avoid feeling the nemesis too. We don't mind taking the credit for the hubris, but we don't call it hubris, we call it, I have done something great here. So, and I'm saying something which is so anti-WASP, you know, Protestant, Western, what is the word? Protestant belief system, because the way the Protestant belief system made all this stuff for us, you know, including the West Coast and all this frontierism, has to do with the faith that you do everything. But time has come, culturally, is the midlife of the culture, if you like. I think that's what America is going through. And I have a fine intuition that by 2000 years, which is a very important millennia, it's a full number, America as a culture, because it's a young culture compared to all the other cultures, is going to step into the midlife. And I think individually you are all feeling that. That's why midlife is such a big thing. Now I have this, I wanted to announce, you perhaps know already, quadrant, this issue, last issue, which is 25, issue number 25, number 1, 1992, quadrant, issue 25, volume 25, which is written in Roman script, and number 1, is announcing an institute, which really immediately makes me think, really, something is there. An institute, and I'm not so sure, I don't know how to think about it yet, but I've just got the information. And there is a card here, the Center for Midlife Development. And you can write, you can... Center for Midlife Development. And you can send it if you want to be part of it or want to be a student, I guess. I don't know, I haven't read the whole thing. So I'm just mentioning this. And by the way, this whole volume is dedicated to midlife crisis. So it's in the air. Let me just tell you quickly the contents. It's an interview with a Jungian and a very famous psychologist from Harvard, whose name you perhaps know, Daniel Levinson, who wrote the book called, Seasons of Life, actually. It's a classic. He's not Jungian, but he knows Jung's work. There's the two interviews with these two men. Arya Meidenbaum is the director of the foundation in Jungian in New York. Then there are essays like Aching in Places Where You Used to Play, A Jungian Approach to Midlife Change by Jeffrey Satinover, who is also, I know him also, is a Jungian. And he's also a neurobiologist. He's working on, he has an institute where he's trying to use scientific methods to understand dreams and so on. Yes, he's in Connecticut. And then Midlife and Spirituality of the Child by two child analysts, I don't know them, and Brennan and Janice Brewey. Then the Demon Lover at Midlife by John Huell, who has a book on romantic love. And then etc. So this is a whole issue dedicated to that. And they're not only that, they are starting an institute. Maybe see what the institute talks about. In other words, they really feel the need to train people to deal with it or talk about it or make it conscious, let's say. The Center for Midlife Development was established with the belief that a person can move from stagnation and uncertainty at midlife to the hidden wealth of personal opportunity and potential available in the second half of life, so on and so forth. So you can send your name and apply for the information stuff. So people are even concretely looking at it. That it's not just an individual ritual anymore. It's a collective ritual. And I think because the culture itself has gone through the youth and beginning to accept the next phase. And the only way you can do it is start it with personal life first. Then you can do it. So we are in midlife, collectively, historically, at least in this continent, it looks like. And what does it mean? And you use the word stuck. We can't, those of you who are thinking how to find a ritual in midlife, we are really in midlife, but we are not only in midlife. And that's what I tried to emphasize last night. We are also trying to not forget the abilities of our youth, and that's the looking backward. And we are also trying to not forget that when you get older, we also have something to look forward to, along with aches and pains and muscle aches. And if we have something to look forward to in old age, the muscle aches can come along with them as a package. We might not mind them so much. And I might have mentioned also last night that people who live fully in where they are between backward, forward, and the transition, they do not mind that what comes with that particular stage as much. If you go from one stage to the other, like you're jumping from room to room and closing the door behind you, then what you see in this room, the room you jumped into, that's all you have got. And we're a lot more critical of it. Mm-hmm. Well, I think that's the majority of people. It's almost like a norm. Well, that's why you have to consciously make, that's why the institute is coming into being. We have to consciously see how we can, and there the other cultures are important. Like the examples I gave you last night, in a Hindu society, when somebody missed the puberty rite, just before the wedding, they have to very briefly reenact it, do it. So you cannot pass it over, you cannot skip it. So what is happening psychologically, you have to remember that I have to have some of these youth issues, youth problems, but if you then know it, instead of either repressing it or closing it off, then perhaps you have a possibility to, you don't have to also be the youth literally. You don't have to start a basketball team at 65. I had a woman friend who, because she needed to do that. She had to go. She'd never had the tomboy phase in her life. She started a basketball team at 65. And her husband said, just shook his head. I said, I don't know what's going on here. I'm leaving. So he just could not figure it out. Here was this, you know, sort of graceful 65, nicely aging wife suddenly goes and starts the basketball team. And of course, you know, culture, her friends all gave her support because it's also very enlightening feminist thing to do. But she had to go through it, and within a few months she realized this was ridiculous for her. So she but for her she needed to do it. But she had to do this. This is the youth. Somehow in individual life we have to keep the youth and the folly of the youth or the beauty of the youth up, not only, again, literally, by working out and being the slim girl at 16, that's for women, it's very important. This obsession with weight and with looks. And the more obsession we see, I'm talking about collective sin now, the more overweight people we see also. This is the one country, and I travel a lot, where you never, never see anywhere in the world so many overweight people as in America. And we can't just say it's food. If it is food, then one has to really do something. There I would like to march in Washington. If the food is all making us fat, let's do something about it. But instead, we are bringing up more food, which will make us slim. And then somebody does the research saying, this can create cancer, or this can do harm. So then the whole thing goes away from the real issue. It becomes a marketing, competitive problem, which is, and then of course we all fall for it, because we haven't dealt with our youth. We want to have our waist slim, so whatever the newest in the market, we go for it, which has nothing to do with youth. So I don't know what that answers. Okay, some people mentioned children's initiation. You work with children, you did, right? Okay, before I forget, I want to say something which came from other people's, you know, introduction. You said you were a storyteller. In my experience, the best initiation for children would be storytelling. Stories, also for adults. But children, I had a friend who teaches inner city kids in New York City and in near Harlem, really explosive area. And she's a psychologist. And she was trying to get these children interested in their lives, who they are, what they're doing. And she tried everything. She tried videos, she tried games, she tried this, that, and that. And one day, some kid said to her, you know, I saw this movie and I didn't like the story. The kid gave that word story. And suddenly, something in her clicked. And she then started telling them stories. And she looked for stories everywhere and found stories. And she found them in rapt attention. They had all, even those kids who have been criminals, delinquents, people don't use the word delinquent anymore. I guess we are now criminals. Anyway, all these kids were absolutely there. So if you know which stories to pick, that would be just a practical suggestion. But that's good for older people too. I'm just going to go answering a few things and then we'll get to the major part of it. Somebody mentioned loss. When you said loss, who did? You did. Somebody did. You did. It's interesting. Now, language, since English is not my mother tongue, for me it's very interesting to notice the language you use, because it's language tells, it's a symbol. Language is a symbol which announces the experience before we ever feel it. There's also one item of culture which changes slowest, is language. Of course, American slang is one exception, because it changes continuously. But language as an entity of culture is very stable. It takes years and years before language changes drastically. So when you say loss, what I hear is sacrifice. And the word sacrifice, church-related people, and I ask them how many times a week or day they use the word. Hardly ever. Sacrifice. And yet, if you take Catholic Church, sacrifice of Christ was a very major event of Christianity. But they would say Christ was crucified. But the word sacrifice has a problem. Loss is not as difficult. But what is loss? You lose your purse in the subway. That's also loss. See, again, we go back to the literal again. Loss is a very benign word. We can use it for losing anything. But if we say a sacrifice, which is involuntary, because if your mother dies, it's not, you don't do it. Or your lover walks out with your best friend, you don't obviously do anything. You don't think you have done anything. But that's a loss. But it's also a sacrifice of something. But in order to call it sacrifice, you can say, what does sacrifice have to do with my losing something? Because then you need to go to the archetypal part. Then you got to need to go into yourself. What are you sacrificing? Or you are bound to sacrifice by this person walking out of your life. Then some of you are going through divorce right now, or some of you who have gone through divorce, if you think back that period and afterwards, what was sacrificed in that marriage by the divorce? Mm-hmm. You have to sit with it for a while. Why Joyce? James Joyce?
No.
Choice. Oh, I thought James Joyce. It's interesting why I heard Joyce rather than choice. I don't know. Yeah. Okay, sacrifice and martyr. And I think people, when they dislike the word sacrifice, because they immediately see martyr. you know, the partners complain, the mother who is always saying, what have I done for you? And, you know, so, but sacrifice has to do with a couple of things. It's voluntary. When Christ knew that he had no choice, and so there comes the choice, but the no choice has to do with not the helplessness as much as, because he has gone through the helpless part already through the desert, but he knew that is he has to. So if you voluntarily do not sacrifice, then it may be a loss. Then it is done on you. Then you have no choice. Then you call it a loss. I don't know. This just comes to me right now. Well, active, but not active in the sense you think action is. Active in the sense that you, when the sacrifice comes to you, you are asked to sacrifice. Think of Christ, that would be easier, his story. Then you go with it. So active in that sense, but not active in the sense that you suddenly one morning decide, I'm going to sacrifice my body or I'm going to sacrifice my child. Abraham, the Bible is wonderful. And here I am a non-Christian, I have to tell you about the Bible. You read your own, and that will go back to the tradition. You read your Bible with a psychological eye and you'll see how much material there is about what you're talking about or everything in life. Abraham was asked to sacrifice his son. And if you go to the, I don't have to tell you the story. You are asked by God. By whom? By something bigger than yourself. You don't have to even believe in God to do that. And I understand your problem being in the Catholic Church where commandments and injunctions were much more important as a child. So it was all get clouded with martyrdom, which is, I'm sacrificing myself for you. That's not the sacrifice I'm talking about. On one level. But when it became secularized as a word, then of course it became a martyring. Don't people say, oh, I'm not a martyr. I mean, it's a terrible thing to be a martyr. That's also interesting. Why sainthood then turned into something very opposite in everyday life? I'm not going to be the martyr. In other words, that's the opposite of, that I have a choice not to be the martyr. Because martyr means I'm doing it for you. There are people who love to do things for them, others. I mean, but we have forgotten because we are so hung up with choice. Am I choosing to do it? It's like ego has to feel tremendously important. That's what Lucretia is saying. Also, if you go back to the real martyrs and saints, they became saints after they were martyrs. Why it became? Because then we took it out of the religious context. Took it out of the God's context, then it becomes a secular word and everybody hates it. See, but all these things you're saying, which is true, has to do with ego being in the center. I'm not being rewarded. And if you have an attitude that goes back to the symbolic again, which is symbolic, then you know that you really are only a little part of it. All I'm asking you to be, that's again Christian, to be a little humble, that's all. We don't really do it. Even when you are very successful, you're making millions by tremendous intelligence and intuition as a business person, huh? You might be very happy about it, but that doesn't mean that you might say, and good business people say that. I've known a few good business people. They're very interesting. They'll say, the real successful ones. I say, no, it's a matter of luck. Matter of the right time, the right place. They don't always take the credit. And Perot, I would have to give him that credit. He does say, of course, in the campaign, he had to say that I know something about money. But he very rarely showed his money success as his qualification. Perot, I don't think he is, because he's a real businessman, real successful. I think he has a humility. He knows. He has a symbolic approach to it somewhere, because he knows that I couldn't be successful if I were only ego-oriented in that. Anybody else remembers? Yeah, good.
If you are asked to sacrifice my life,
I think I said it afterwards also. It's like, you know, if you lose something, don't worry about it. Either it's not necessary at the moment, or it will come back. Okay, people who are working with loss, you are at a loss. how to really, because it's a tremendous painful situation, how do you help them to go through that as an initiation, as an initiatory principle? Every death, think of the death of a close person, all of you, your mother, father, lover, children, whoever, the really close people. Every death, no matter how much you fought with your mother, when the mother dies, it's an enormously profound experience. The worst, perhaps, is the loss of a child, because it's young. This person is not supposed to die yet. So those of you who unfortunately lost a young child or lost a niece or nephew or whoever, next generation, you know how painful it is. When that happens, if we have no choice, speaking of choice, somebody just died. Death brings something very interesting after we go through the mourning. There comes the ritual again. And that ritual does not mean that you have to do it the way the Hindus do it, but you have to consciously feel that enormous pain. And that's why I was so furious when somebody mentioned that the doctors are making up more and more drugs to numb the grieving. Because one thing is left in our life in terms of pain, which is grieving. It's very grieving and guilt. Guilt is another thing nobody can rationalize. That something really is under the skin of Judeo-Christian tradition. You cannot get rid of guilt. You can do anything you want, but it's there like amoebic dysentery in the tropical country, or I don't know, herpes in this country. It just doesn't go, and it don't go. So guilt we can come back later, but the grief. And when you go through the grief, and I always call it a gift of death, something happens to the survivor, which is a gift of death. For example, the biggest gift that happens is that you learn to sacrifice rather than to lose and feel a loser. Now, that's another interesting language. He's a loser. And only in this country you hear that term. It's interesting to me to note these things. Why should that be a bad thing? Somebody wins, somebody loses. That's life's game. If you have a game of two groups, one wins, obviously, automatically the other loses. Why calling somebody a loser is such a bad thing? As if you can win all the time. All right, so if you know that this literal is not the only thing you say, and you don't have to be even symbolic to see that, that if somebody wins, the other person has to lose, or you have to lose next week. You know, like the breakthrough you had with your patient, the week after you have this falling down from heaven with another. So winning and losing, winning wouldn't be important unless we lost. But why? But that's my, as a non-American, I hear it all the time, in America we do that. Question is, why in America you have to do that? Then we have to attack the word choice. I get very nervous when I hear these very knowledgeable feminist leaders, including Gloria Steinem. I was in college when she first emerged, the long blonde hair and very dynamic. And when she went, we used the word choice every other sentence. I thought, oh my God, you know, there's something going on here. Anyway, so that's why I like the other lady who is against her right now. Personally. No, it's very new. She's Camille. Even though she might be coming from another end, but at least she's trying to get Gloria Steinem to see a few things. But depends how you're using the sentence. We create our own reality. Of course, you have to forgive me because I'm coming from a culture where, of course, ego is much more subordinate to the self to begin with. So I'm brought up with that. So I'm making point a little strongly than you can digest, perhaps. But maybe that's why you invited me, I don't know. But so that you can hear it. But to go back to your... I'll come to you in a minute. To back to your point, we create our reality, our complexes, our archetypes within us, because we are also part of this bigger scheme, and there goes back to the cyclical thing. We don't create it as ego. We create it unknowingly or knowingly, because we are a product of many different aspects, which is our potential creative life also. We are part of many different gods and goddesses. We are part of many unknown complexes, which are full of energy. From that point of view, we do. But ego doesn't. But in America, the literalization of the self and ego is the problem. Okay, now you had a hand, sorry. Now before you get away, did you want to hear? Well, what do we do? What does ego do? Let's start from the ego point of view. You get up in the morning, you look at your calendar, well, that's what I do, and I see who is coming, who is not coming, and then you go at it. You go by the clock, and you do things. You buy shop for food, you arrange, organize that you have to go to the workshop Saturday, so you have to do other things Friday, what you usually do on Saturday. This organizing principle, outer organizing principle, writing the letters, answering the phone calls, correspondence, paying tax, all these things are very important part of life because these are the concrete things in our life that we have to attend to. That's ego's job. Ego also assimilates things like you are doing right now. You're listening to things and you are cooking it. Your ego takes it in, selects it, and puts it into the pot, internal pot. And it's like the cook. Let's say you are cooking a soup. You choose which vegetables to take in because certain vegetables don't go with certain meats. Okay? So you take it and you put it in the pot. And then you close it and it's cooking. And then when somebody says, my God, this is a wonderful stew. How did you make it? If you are a real good cook, you say, today it came out this way. You don't say, here's the recipe. Because the recipe does not always do the same thing. Anybody here who has ever done cooking knows that. But we don't ever acknowledge that. So there you are already letting ego take the humble position. Otherwise we are into hubris. Oh, I'm the only one who can do this. You know? I don't think a good cook would ever say that. Or in another area. We don't really do it. Even when you sew a dress, or when nobody does that anymore, but anyway, another example, I don't know, your gardening. What do you do besides your job? Okay. Now, that's a wonderful example. Now, in pottery, of course you are doing it, and you feel great because you are really in contact with the clay with your fingers. But as you know, every pot comes out differently. And in Japan, there's a wonderful tradition, all old cultures, and they say even the best potter or the best painter, many of you are into art, and best artist, always intentionally leaves a little defect because only gods do it perfect. Now there comes another word, perfection. And migraine, menstrual pain, let's say back pain, all those things are very closely connected to perfection, by the way. And many of us, some of the particular kinds of pains are connected to perfection. You might not use the word perfection, but you are heading toward, you believe that you have a choice to be perfect and you are trying very hard. And if you're brought up in a family where you are pumped for perfection, and that's a major problem because it gets into the body. And migraine can almost equal perfection, often. And when the medical researchers say there is no cure, migraine, because they, no wonder, because they can't find a physio-organic base because it has so much to do with the attitude. And even any of you have migraine here? Okay, so you have... There are worse things than being perfectionist. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, because it's the ego. Perfectionism has to do with ego in the center. So anything spiritual has to do with ego serving the self. Now, I'm glad you said, because you must notice when it started going away, I'm sure that when ego began to surrender somehow, maybe ego had no choice. Because ego is essential, but it's only a little center of the outer world, outer life. And part of American problem is, and this is the American midlife journey, I think. Because for American youth, which is all, no matter what age, to recognize that I can't have that much of ego-centered life anymore, like we have felt when we left 30, 35. In fact, it's not even that satisfying. When you see that you can do everything you learn to do well, it starts getting boring. One of the symptoms of midlife crisis is boredom. The French say, no, ennui, and they make it a very eternal part of their life, because it's like you're stuck in something, you're bored. And that stuckness can be ego's doing very well. Ego has done wonderfully. You can fly airplanes, you can write papers every night, you are a journalist or you are an opera singer, you stand on the stage and my God, people just clap, and what a wonderful feeling, you come home but then you drink or, you know, do something, because most of these high performers have very sad lives, because not all of them, but many of them. Look at Maria Callas, look at, what was this Boston ballet dancer, just taking drugs to, yeah. And then they write a book for us to know. So what is it? It has to do with ego perfection, and even ego gets bored with it. And that's your rule of thumb clue. When you start getting bored with yourself in some areas, especially the areas you are doing very well, then you know that time has come for ego to take the back seat. Dreams are wonderful in this time, because many dreams invariably will show you that ego has to, like you are driving, and somebody dreamt, I remember now, the man was 43, and every dream had to do with car, because he had to drive long distances to go everywhere, including to analysis. And somebody else is always driving. And this somebody else is, and in life he's extremely in control. He makes, you know, what, $10,000 a week or something, very successful businessman. And yet, and he just couldn't understand, how come, and he loves driving his car, which is very high-powered, how come in the dreams somebody else is driving his car? And those somebody else's are very strange people. One is this next-door neighbor who is no good, alcoholic or something. All these very, what Jungians would call the shadow figures, including the fool, the stupid, the, you know, the dumbling, all these people, and he just couldn't believe this brother. He hasn't done a thing, and he's driving his car. And in reality, he wouldn't even let him touch his car. And one day, the dream came, the car is moving by itself, and he's at the back seat. And he had a very luminous experience. So, at last, his self is in control. Because he felt like, you know, he was sort of shivering. And it could, of course, it looks like a ghost, and the car is moving. But he knew something in him, which he doesn't even know existed, is driving the car. What usually brings people to analysis? A relationship crisis. He was having affair after affair after affair after affair, and he knew. Now, that's an interesting question, because he got bored with it. He knew, even he knew, and also he's now 40, late 40s, so he knew that he's not as handsome, and he's having a little time getting women at noticing him, so he's thinking he has to go a little afield to find a new market. So he is getting a little tired, you know, he's a businessman, a good businessman, so he knew that he's very astute as a businessman, so he knew if I have to make so much effort to get attention from a woman, something is not right here. I'm failing in my business skill. But he's smart enough to know that, of course, somebody then gave a huge shock. Somebody he approached and she said no, which never happened to him. So that really, the rejection brought him to analysis. And within a month, that topic was irrelevant. Because he kept having these dreams without women, just driving. He was a driven man, and driving, and drivers. So that was his main thing. He has a two or three phones in his car, and a CD, and a bar, and all this. So car is like his little life. And he is, you know, it's wonderful, because he always calls me from the car if he's 5 minutes late. So that's good, because then I know. So that's the advantage of this man's, all the technology, but deep down, a very sad person. And he needed to come down to that level. And the moment self took charge of the steering wheel, and it's interesting that there was no figure. So it's not yet clear, the image is not yet clear in his mind. And he is a different person. He's humble. He keeps saying, business is not everything. So, I don't, going back to loss again, so I guess you get the point. When we can help our clients or patients to realize that loss is a necessary sacrifice, I don't know how you can do it. then the grieving is automatic. Oops, yeah. Mm-hmm. I was going to say anger is very important. Well, there again, ego comes in. Ego knows I don't deserve anything. Okay, let's say from going from loss to sacrifice, there are steps, like a ladder. Loss to sacrifice, if we are convinced that that's where we need to go, then I would say anger, or rage, if you want to call it, then blame. This happens with also terminal disease. Punishment, and you can come up with more perhaps, and I would say these are the steps toward the sacrifice. And as a therapist, you have to acknowledge each one of them fully. If somebody says, I'm absolutely furious that I have cancer, and you have to support it. And this is any emotion, pure emotion, is perfectly all right. What is problematic when people cannot feel, then is the problem. And your job is to somehow help the person to feel, which is not to judge the person. In other words, the reason people can't feel anger, because they feel if they're angry, maybe it happened in their childhood, then somebody will punish them. You have to always smile and say, I'm fine. Everything is fine. When I first came here, people would ask me, the starting sentence when you greet somebody is different in different cultures. So people immediately say, how are you? And perhaps you don't even notice it is so common here. And I always thought, why, number one, why are they so interested in how I am? Because I took it, you know, very seriously. And why are they, if I tell them, I did sometimes to some close friends, well, I'm not feeling too good today, which was the truth. They don't seem to be interested. So they're going away. Because nobody's interested, it became a symbol of greeting. So I, of course, not being from the culture, took it as a literal expression of how are you. So, but that's the way people say when they want to know how you are, really. And so that has to do with, also partly, nobody wants to know your pain. My mother died when I was in this country as a student. And I was absolutely, speaking of mourning, I was absolutely amazed at the reaction of my classmates and my professors, as if nothing has happened. And that was so incredible to me, because in other cultures it's just the opposite. They would create a ritual to wail and cry together. People who never knew my mother, just so that I can be in these emotions. Or I was away, so guilt would be a thing. Why couldn't I be there? And my other siblings had to take care of her. Oops, oh, thank you. So anyway, I'll just finish. To avoid pain, and I think we can do it very easily ourselves in our practice if we're not used to being in it. And that one thing could do. So grieving, what I'm trying to say to you, or somebody mentioned how to learn a ritual, if you stay in it, ritual comes to you. And we'll elaborate further. The brief break coming up. is to respond to your questions and hopes and introductions briefly, and they might come back again. Now I'm going to tell you what we are going to do the rest of the day. There are a couple of things you can do as a starter. We break at 1, right? For lunch. So until lunch, if you want, we can continue with what we're doing in terms of if you have any questions from last night's lectures who are there and who are not there might still benefit from it. That would be one possibility. If not, then we'll continue what we're doing right now until 1, and then I'll give you some other structures. I want to read a couple of stories, and then you will separate from each other and be alone for about half an hour. And it's a big building, you can go outside if you like. And let just things come to you. There is a reaction to the story that you would read. And then you can paint or draw or write something. Or you can do something that I suggested last night, somebody mentioned a dream. If you had a dream last night after the lecture or without the lecture, or you have a kind of an image of where you are. You forget in terms of your age, where you are in terms of your past and your future. You can draw it, you can write a few lines, you can write a poem, you can do anything you want, a creative expression of what you are discussing. Because otherwise what happens is we remain too much into the logos, and because we are using words, and words are of course symbolic, but we can then get into, you know, like the tennis match, we back and forth, and we need to sometimes take a break from the match and break from just listening to words. And that's what, and I find it very useful in a long day workshop to do that. So that would be the second half of the day. So I would suggest not to eat a very full stomach, because what happens is if we eat too much, it happens to me anyway, which is then all the energy goes to the stomach for at least an hour, literally, to digest the food. Of course, most Americans eat light lunch anyway. But today is very good to have. Also, fasting is very important. I'm not saying that we should fast today, but when you fast sometimes, not for dieting purpose only, but if something, by the way, which I forgot to mention, with every ritual, fasting is involved, which just comes to me. And when you get married, you fast until the wedding is over. And in Hindu wedding, the wedding starts in the afternoon at the sunset, and it goes with, and it's a beautiful expression that the bride looks the most beautiful when the setting sun falls on her face. And that's the time the wedding begins. So even if you're the ugliest woman, you'd look beautiful. So after the wedding is over, all day, both bride and groom fasted, and then they eat for the first time. All rituals, the first naming, first food, the first chalk in hand, all of them, until the ceremony takes place, people fast. The initiant fasts. Fasting has to do with becoming closer to God. The word in Sanskrit is upobash, which means near, living near God. So when you fast, when you eat less, you feel light. You feel something physically. Also, it's easier to be in that realm which is more symbolic. But not when you are doing it because you've got to lose 5 pounds by next week. But if you do it, and those of you who are really dieting, try that out. Try to fast in a way which has nothing to do with your weight. Fast because you have discovered something as a self-image or self-figure that you can call your god or your goddess, something sacred. And that's another word is very important. Now, okay, so I'll just stop at, yeah, something like that. But you have to have a sense of sacred with it. Three things are needed in a ritual, those of you who are trying to create ritual. One is a sacred space. First, we need an initiant, somebody who is being initiated. I think that's good to say. Then you need a community. But there could be individual rituals. Secret rituals. Secret and sacred come from the same root. So those of you who are therapists and are constantly worried about people not telling you everything, you are on the wrong track. Because if a patient cannot keep a secret from the therapist or analyst, then there's something to really worry about. Because that's another sign of adulthood, to me anyway. And because somebody has the capacity to hold something, doesn't have to speak it up. And this, of course, goes with American culture very strongly. You think the word confession is not used, but what is the word used? Sharing, telling. My life is an open book. And all these things go really against psychological reality, because you can share, you can tell, but you need to also have that capacity to hold something which is very close to your soul, which no other human being needs to know. Just because you are going to a therapist and paying doesn't mean therapist is your God. And the therapists have to be very careful not to create that atmosphere. And it goes with child abuse, the sexual abuse in childhood. This is a whole group of people. They're badgering the patient out to get to the memory. And I think it's very strong violation to the psyche. Psyche has a way to bring the information, if one needs to have it. Now, there goes back again trust in the nature. I always say people, you know, there was a thing about birth trauma therapy, some in the 60s or 70s, primal scream. And I always say, if you are rebirthing, if we are supposed to remember how we felt when we were born, we would have remembered it. That's the rule of thumb I go by. Nature has a way for us to forget, to repress, to suppress, because human ego is very weak. And here we are inflating it to such an extent, and ego is saying, leave me alone, I can't do all this job. So when you forget something, when we're children, we of course would repress. We can't deal with all this pain. When we see our parents making love, let's say, or we see them fighting, or something, the big adult stuff, as a child, we have to avoid it. And then, it goes back to initiation, then when you're older, if that particular event remains in my psyche in a way that is eating my energy, then, of course, psyche would bring it back. All we have to do is to watch and be there. And so I'm dead against provoking people, either through hypnosis, unless there's an indication by a dream or by something physical that this is starting to come out, wanting to come out. Then think of childbirth. You can induce a labor. But in natural childbirth, the child can only come out, the baby can only come out when there's enough dilation, and then the push works. So there has to be timing. It's extremely important. And so many of you are working with other people. Don't push until there's dilation, meaning there is an indication, either from a dream, that's why dreams are so important, either from a dream or from a feeling or a sensation or an event that is trying to come out. Then you can just be there like the midwife to catch the baby. The baby will come out anyway. So it's not that much work that we need to do. When we work too hard in a session and you are exhausted by the end of the day, after 5 hours or 6 hours or 8 hours of work, you definitely know that you have done something wrong. Because this work should be nourishing the therapist as much as the patient. Not to say you don't have difficulties and you shouldn't have sleepless nights, but it should not be exhausting in the sense, boy, do I feel tired. And when people ask, how do you do this all day? Aren't you exhausted? And I said, no, I feel energized by it. Unless I am greedy enough to take 10 patients a day, that would be exhausting. Because then ego is coming in. And this is one profession where self has to be in the center. Okay, digressed again. So we need these three things. The other is, I don't know what word to use, let's say sacred or divine. Those of you who left church because it doesn't do it for you, or left the religion because it doesn't do it for you, you don't have to go by sacred, by what you were brought up, what you thought was sacred, but it would be helpful to keep that image. Let's say you were brought up in a Catholic church and you saw Christ's image or crucifixion as a child. It goes into your system. You left the church because of the patriarchy or because of all the sexual stuff that is anti-life or whatever, but that does not mean that that image has gone out of your life. You'd be amazed how that image remains there and comes back when you really need it most, but you have to be ready to see it. Again, the same thing. You have to be there in a way that you can see it. You can recognize it. I had a friend who was coming from the Brahmin caste, the people who do all these rituals, the Upanayana, this one, from India. And he was this very great scholar, a philosopher, and I think a historian also, wrote a lot of books, and he teaches here in this country in a very high-powered university. He had a consistent dream. And it was not very powerful, but the dream kept with him because it comes back every other month or every other week. So when he heard I became a Jungian, we were colleagues at some point, and he said, oh, by the way, you guys work with dream. What do you think of this dream? Very casually. And I have had it at least 10 times in the last few years. And the dream was that he opens the freezer, you know, the freezer section of the refrigerator, and he takes out this Ziploc bag, and he knows that he has to open it to thaw something in the Ziploc bag. And those were little frozen gods, images of little Indian gods and goddesses. So I said, your gods are frozen. So, you know, it's such an simple image. Anybody wouldn't have to be a Jungian to see that. And obviously in the dream, it's very important to see what the dream ego we call it, who is dreaming, in the dream does. I said, you obviously take it out automatically, you have to do something with it. It's to thaw. Or if you leave it in the outside, it's going to thaw automatically. So you have to thaw your gods. That's as clear as that. He comes from an extremely religious, automatically religious background where they go through all these rituals very carefully. And he officially, by tradition, was supposed to be becoming a priest. That was his tradition, which he didn't. So for him, it was even doubly important to not to forget those gods. But interestingly enough, psyche shows that they're not gone. They're frozen for the time being. And there was another dream where another Indian person dreamt that she was walking around the river, and it was a dry river. There are parts of India where the winter time is dry season, so the rivers are dry up, and then the rainy season comes. We have a huge season called rainy season. So when I was writing this paper, this lecture I was preparing, I was thinking that you have four seasons, and we have actually six seasons. So for an Indian psyche, it will be very interesting to see how the seasons, outer seasons, also connect to the inner seasons. And so we have winter, which is very brief. We have spring, which is even briefer. Then we have this long summer, which is interrupted by rainy season. So it's another way of looking at it. And then comes the autumn, which is beautiful but brief. And then comes the brief winter. So that will tell you that in Indian psyche, if we take the liken, the seasons and the inner seasons, it would be quite different story than in the American psyche. So anyway, that's another little digression. So, pardon? I'm sure it does, absolutely. For me, because I lived here more than half of my life, and I lived in India, but it's interesting how many other things are connected with season. Like in India, of course, it looks like I have to digress. In India, music, clothes of course have to do with climate, food, language, games, all these things come with the particular season. So when there's a rainy day, even after all these years, I immediately feel craving for that particular dish which you cook in rainy days. Music have all these different moods in the music. Those of you who know anything about Indian music, has to do with not only seasons, but also emotions. Mood of loneliness, mood of... So music connects with the emotion in a way that it doesn't have to be something esoteric and something that you have to learn in a conservatory to be able to appreciate or play. And of course you have to learn years and years to play, but you can appreciate because it's culture-bound, it's experience-bound. So it's like season of life connects with the season, outer season and inner season. So I'm sure I haven't thought about it because that's what I was thinking about as I was preparing this, that maybe for an Indian psyche, the autumn, which would be the midlife, is only a transition. Spring, which is the early life, is only a transition. We used to joke in Calcutta, which is the city, that we knew that spring is here by certain trees on the roadside which bloomed, jacaranda trees, which bloom only a week, beautiful purple flowers. And we have to go for vaccination. And interestingly enough, that was the vaccination time for smallpox. Interestingly enough, it's the same word. Spring and vaccination is the same word. Can you believe that? I mean, no, sorry, it's not vaccination. Smallpox and spring, same word. And that's the time, which is the time to take the vaccination for smallpox, which is still true. You have to do it. So spring was for us vaccination and a brief period of beautiful colors. There are flowers which bloom through the year, but these particular flowers bloomed only a week. So we were struck by it. So we were struck by the spring is here, and by the time we realize it, spring is gone. So youth is perhaps not as important in that culture. This is, I'm just venturing a guess. Well, vaccination, well, it is disease, yes. certain diseases, because, of course, if you look at the climatic factor, even in this country, when the winter is not strong enough, which is supposed to be, you get a lot more disease. So when the nature is not natural enough, then the viruses and the bacteria thrive. So being a very short spring is also was the time for disease, it could be. That's another way of looking at it. But the summer being very long, so what happens is the marking of the youth to the midlife is a open area. So between, let's say, if we don't take youth, I'm just guessing because of the seasons, if we don't take youth so seriously.
And that is the end of the tape. Copyright CG Jung Society, Seattle, and the speaker. All rights reserved. No copying, please.